Off the ball
on News Talk
in association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
We have Niall Kelly here in studio, who wrote The Choice with Philly McMahon, Air Sport Book of the Year. Congratulations, Niall. Well done. You're very welcome. We have John Green, editor of the Sunday Independent Sports section, here in studio. And we have Kieran Cunningham from The Star here as well. So we're talking about sports books 2017. We'll get on to your magnificent achievement and spend a good 25 minutes teasing out your wonderfulness, Niall. But John, last week you wrote a piece making the point that actually you thought 2017 was a very good year for sports books, Irish sports books, a return to form.
Yeah, I think so. I was a judge on the Air Sport Book of the Year Awards. This was my first year doing it, and it was a great year to be involved. You know, there's 10 or 12 books out there this year that are of a very high standard, not just good, but really good. There has been a feeling in recent years with books that, you know, the big autobiography from the big sports there that didn't really have much depth to it had dominated the genre, and it was a bit worrying. I think it was off-putting for people. I don't know, I can't back it up with numbers or anything, but I'm pretty sure that people were voting with their pockets and staying away from those kinds of books. And what we've got this year is a really good crop. We happen to have some very good autobiographies, which is great. Mm. But even better, we've got more sports books telling us stories, like, you know, Barry Ryan's cycling book or the Cormac McAnallan book, or, you know, those kind of books, the Lions 1971. Mm. I think that's really welcome, and hopefully that's the start of going back to taking the genre of sports books seriously.
Well, as Liverpool go 1-0 up, 90 minutes gone, it looks like Coutinho, based on the celebrations. It's moved down the left-hand side. They're against Bournemouth, and they're going at pace, as Liverpool tend to do, and cut inside, and it's scored at the near post. That looks like Coutinho from this distance. Yeah, I'm getting nods all around. Coutinho, so 1-0 Liverpool after 20 minutes. On that point, John, we were talking earlier, Richie and I, and it's a particularly susceptible genre to turkeys, because if you have a big name in the world of sports, your book will sell, even if it's no good. Whereas generally, if we were writing a piece of fiction or doing things the right way, you would send a sample of your work into the publisher, who would read it and think, this is very good, this is well written, I'm going to publish this on its merits, as opposed to, I'm Stephen Gerrard, here's a pile of mush, you and I both know that doesn't really matter anyway, and out we go. So the sports autobiography is especially susceptible to not being very good.
Yeah, especially if, you know, the subject of it is really just in it for the money, and that has become more apparent that it was a cynical exercise on cashing in across the sports. But, you know, in GA soccer and rugby in particular, it was a problem. And I don't know what's happened this year, but we've been really lucky with the sports autobiographies that we've gotten this year, because they're really, by and large, there are very few of them that are turkeys. Mostly they're very good, and two sports autobiographies made the shortlist for the Book of the Year Awards, and both of them are excellent, and there is a couple of others as well. So I'm just hoping that publishers are saying to themselves, okay, we need to, or maybe it's just as well that we just happen to have a good crop of sports writers at the moment as well that are serious about the craft. You know, Niall is here, and I mean, he's done an amazing job on Philly McMahon's book. Equally, Christy O'Connor, who's a great track record with Jackie Terrell's book. So, there's a happy coincidence of a few things coming together, and that we use 2017 maybe as kind of ground zero with sports books, certainly in Ireland, and that we're starting again looking next year, and that publishers see the reaction to this year's crop of books, and that encourages them to go out and to promote those kind of books again for next year.
Well, one of the things I found interesting is the last few years on that Air Sport Awards, like Philly's book won this year, Kieran Donaghy won last year, John Leonard the year before, the year before that, like the three GA books and the three very different GA books. And the big revolution in Irish sports publishing has been the way the GA books have changed, because, like, John, you remember this, how bad they used to be. Like, Liam Hayes' Out of Our Skins was the game changer, because up to that they were incredibly formulaic. There'd be an opening chapter that was about the player's childhood, then they go into their joining their club.
They're what I would have always called the and then books, and yeah. then and then and then and then yeah. and then and
so
then it was
yeah,
over.
It would just run through their career. There would be a so-called supposedly controversial chapter near the end of what changes they would like to see in the GA, and then a chapter on the best 15 players I played against or with. And that was it. They were so dull.
The hardest men.
Yeah, but Liam Hayes, because Liam Hayes, if you know where Liam came from, he was a top Gaelic footballer. He was playing midfield for one of the best teams in the country. At the time, they won All-Irelands and Meath, but he was also chief sports writer of the Sunday Press. So, like, I remember he going back, he was like, Meath were preparing for an All-Irelands semi final, and he was off covering the McGuigan Steve Cruz fight in Las Vegas a couple of weeks before. So, he was trying to marry two very, very different lives, and he was just complete. Like, people always bring up how honesty when they're praising a book that they, you know, he was so honest. They're saying Jackie Tyrrell was very honest, or John Lennon very honest, but honesty is very selective. But I think Liam Hayes was the first one who brought that honesty out. And he spoke very openly about his brother's suicide and about even the impact within the Meath dressing room of him being a journalist and how that went down. And you can imagine it didn't go down particularly well with a lot of people. But also there's been a sea change, I think, Joe, in how publishers are thinking. Because I remember a few years ago, so it was about 7 years ago, I interviewed John Leonard, and he talked about a lot of this stuff about going to minor training stoned out of his head, dabbling in heroin, violent incidents in Australia, how he went off the rails when Pat Gilroy joined him. And he was writing a blog, and I read his blog, and I said, you can write really well, John. You have an English degree. Why don't you write a book? You have an amazing story. And he said, no, I have been thinking about that, but you know, I haven't a notion how to go about it. And I said, well, I know a publisher. I'll put you in touch with them, and I'll get in touch with them. I'll tell them as well, and you get in touch with them as well. And we did that, and they never came back to them. And then Penguin, he just approached Penguin, or the Blue Penguin, a massive publisher got it. And it ended up doing really well and won Sports Book of the Year. So some publishers, I think, would look at it and say, you know, he's a Dublin sub goalkeeper. Who cares? Mm. And I think people have opened their... Like a few years ago, if Niall went to a publisher, I think it said, we have a Dublin player who won 5 All-Irelands, he's going to write a book, but he's hardly going to mention Gaelic football in it. They might have said, what? But you know, you look at the book that comes out of it. You know, publishers have become more open to good ideas too, I think.
Yeah. So we might see what the Venn diagram throws up here. Kieran Cunningham, your top five.
Okay.
In no particular order. I mean, you can put an order in it if you want to.
Because
no,
I honestly don't have an order. Yeah, and that's not just because Niall's bigger than me. He's sitting beside me. But Philly McMahon's book, The Ascent, Barry Ryan, the biography of Bob Paisley by Ian Herbert, Quiet Genius.
Yeah.
What else did I put
Green
there?
Shoots.
Oh, Green Shoots, Michael Walker's book on Irish football, North and South.
Davy Hannigan,
Boy Wonder. I talked like people have mixed views on this, but there's a few reasons I liked it a lot now. But okay. Those will be my top five.
Niall Kelly, do you want to give us your top five? I like that you have the choice in your top five.
I did put it in under duress. I feel like I thought it would have looked slightly unusual to leave it out.
Okay. So Niall Kelly's the choice is in Niall Kelly's top five. Excellent.
And then also the other two nominees from the Air Sport Book of the Year shortlist, which were Jackie Tyrrell's and Christy O'Connor's The Warrior's Code, and Barry Ryan's The Ascent, which if I was to pick a favourite of the year, that for me was my outstanding Irish sports book of the year. Like, right. That's the one that I enjoyed the most.
Okay, we'll come back to that.
And the other two then, Jonathan Eigg's unbelievably comprehensive biography of Muhammad Ali, and Centaur by Declan Murphy and Amy Rowe, which is a complete phenomenal achievement in its own right for many different reasons, which I'm sure we'll get onto.
Yeah, for sure. John?
Okay, well, The Ascent by Barry Ryan, The Choice, Philly McMahon and Niall, The Warrior's Code by Jackie Tyrrell and Christy O'Connor, Form, the Kieran Fallon book with Oliver Holt, and lastly, The Pursuit of Perfection, the story of Cormac McAnallan's life.
Yeah, which I've heard great things about, actually.
It's a brilliant book.
Really great things. Like, I mean, to the point where someone was saying, like, as amazing as Philly McMahon's book is with you, Niall, someone was saying, who knows, it may not even be the best book about a GA player's brother.
Yeah,
I know. You know, it's what a kind of
weird coincidence.
It's not
an easy read, but it's a really good book.
Okay. Let's talk about Philly and The Choice.
Okay.
Had you written a book before?
No, this is my first one.
Okay. Do you approach Philly? Does Philly approach you?
No, as I was explaining to Kieran and to John outside, the publisher approached me and said that they were setting up meetings. So sometimes the way the process works, I'm led to believe, is that an athlete will come with his or her ghost of choice already in tow, and the publisher will basically say, okay,
yeah,
go on and work away. In this case, Philly didn't have a ghost of choice when he signed on with Gill to do the project. So they arranged three meetings with three different journalists to essentially let Philly have a feel for it, the people that they thought might be good and people that he might be able to work with. And yeah, we sat down and we had a...
Where did you meet?
We met in the Crown Plaza Hotel in Santry, which, as Philly has often joked, me being from the parish of St. Vincent's in Marino and him being from Ballymun, had to cross and meet somewhere in the middle. But
had you met him before?
Only in a couple of huddles out and about doing interviews.
No,
never had a chance to sit down one-on-one with him and have a chat. And it was funny, actually, when we went to meet, the publisher was running a little bit later, the commissioning editor was running a little bit late, and myself and himself had a chance to sit down and chat about everything bar the book for about half an hour, 45 minutes, and really just talk about football, talk about me and myself, talk about him and himself, like just small talk really, but to kind of get a feel for each other and what we were all about. And then when we sat down to talk, it became very apparent, or I had a very good sense before I went in, that Philly's idea for the book was not going to be Dublin football. Yeah. Like he's still playing, he still has ambitions to win many more All-Irelands with this Dublin team and to continue on his playing career for many more years. So this wasn't going to be a Dublin football book. And we managed to get to the core of it very quickly when he asked me who I thought that this book would be aimed at and who I thought this book could connect with. And on top of obviously Dublin football fans and GAA fans more broadly, which I thought was a given for any book written by a GAA athlete, the three groups that I singled out were people, like young people who might have been in a similar position to Philly and his brother John, who might be at risk of going down the wrong route in life, for want of a better way of phrasing it. Families like Philly's family who have had to deal with having a family member who struggles with any form of addiction, not necessarily heroin addiction, but any form of addiction. And then society more generally. Philly has obviously in the last 2 to 3 years has been campaigning and has lent his voice to trying to get society to change the way that we approach drug addicts and how we deal with drug addicts, how we treat drug addicts, how we relate to drug addicts. And I kind of sense that as I said those three things to him, he kind of just looked at me as if to say, yeah, you get it. Mm-hmm. You get it.
And how quickly after that first meeting do you get the call to say it's you?
It was a couple of days later. Okay. I couldn't say specifically, but it was within a very short space of time. Right. I think he realised that I understood what the project was about. I think the fear always is that when you don't know the ghost, you don't have a pre-existing relationship with the ghost, that they might go off on a solo run. They might think this is what it's going to be about and they might force the agenda to suit their idea. Whereas I think from day one, nearly, thankfully, I managed to assure him that we were on the same page and that I was buying into his vision and his idea for it.
And what was the process then? Do you sit down once a week, twice a week, for how long?
Yeah, a couple of times a week, right. A couple of hours at a go. And that Crown Plaza Hotel in Santry, they got to know us very well to the point where they knew Philly's lunch order off by heart. They didn't even need to come down and take it nearly. A lot of early mornings as well. We were kind of I was trying to get in before I went back to my day job in the 42. He was trying to get in before he went off to run his business empire of gyms and food preparation companies and all the rest that goes with it. And we kind of just, it was very, from a time perspective, it was very full on in that initial stage, because the idea was to get all of that done and all of that out of the way and boxed off while being as disruptive or causing as little disruption as possible to his football. And we managed to achieve that, which was, I think, our kind of the great success of our time management. But it was...
Why is it the winner, John?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. You know, I've heard it said, and I said this to Niall outside, and so he knows where I'm coming from on this. I've heard it's been described as the outstanding sports book of the year. It's not the outstanding sports book of the year. It's one of the outstanding sports, because there are, you know, the ones that were on that shortlist and the others that have been mentioned here are also outstanding. And, you know, Barry Ryan's book in particular, like, pushed it all the way, right? Pushed it all the way. And it's probably just... It's a really well-written book. The story is just incredible. For me, the real power of it came when you get two-thirds of the way into the book and you think, you know, that's pretty much it, but, you know, there's still another third left. I've got the whole story. And then it just goes into almost like, this 30 or 40-page soliloquy of unbelievable brilliant writing, but it's just an unbelievable tour de force from Philly about his attitude to life and about what he's going doing with himself and how he sees things. And it's just incredible. It's just this, you don't know what's going, you don't see it coming. You don't know, you think you've reached the end of the story 2/3 of the way in, and then it's just, he just lets rip then. It's like, you know, the last 10 minutes of an All-Ireland final, and you just, he's just let rip. And about Ballymun, about Dublin, about football, about himself, about business, about education, about learning. And it's just powerful. And that was the clincher for me, was to have got to that point and then to be able to do that, then to keep you so engaged. And there was just something else I wanted to say about it. He did a Q&A the other day at the presentation with Niall, with Kieran McSweeney asking the questions. And apart from the fact that it was very strange to have a 30-minute Q&A with a Dublin footballer that basically didn't mention football, I think it might have even been the last question, he was asked, can you sum up in a few words why you wrote this book? And I thought, wow, that's a really hard question for anyone. And straight away, he just thought for a second, and then he just said, because it was the right thing to do. And I thought that was such an amazing answer to give. Under pressure, like we're all sitting there watching, and he just said, because it was the right thing to do. And there was no kind of pretense around that. It just came. And you know, that kind of copper fastened it in my head then, that, you know, we'd made the right choice at the end.
I should say I haven't had a chance to read it yet, because quite often what happens in here is, depending on who's available on what days, you read their books. So, I mean, Jason Sherlock's been in, Owen Hand, Kieran Fallon, Frank Bruno, Colm Cooper. Got around to all them, but I'm looking forward to reading this over Christmas. Kieran, you've read it. So as I understand it, it's about his brother John, who ultimately succumbs to addiction, and Philly is musing up the choices we have in life or don't have to the point.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the way it's framed, he goes through a lot of different choices that had been made along the road, and looks at the road not taken and the one he could possibly have taken. If he said, like Philly said at one point, if he was closer in age to John, he might have been increased the likelihood he'd gone down the same road. But I remember I went into the office one day and I was there, and I took it home and I just started reading and didn't put it down till I finished it. And I sent Niall a message on Twitter that night that it was fantastic. Like, I was just blown away by it. And they're an interesting graduate, because I just think of coming in here, the last time I was in here with anybody from Sunday Independent Sport, we ended up giving enough material for half of John Costello's convention report. since then, what I found interesting since then is there's a lot of stuff coming out about the Dublin, people within the Dublin. They've been quite open for all the flack that they're not. I've heard, like, Paul Flynn was in here. Yeah. I listened to the podcast interview with Dermot Connolly the other day, and even though it was a fans interview, so it's going to be fairly soft, there's a lot of interesting stuff in it. And a lot of the others as well, that they're a really interesting bunch. And I think Gavin has always gone on about the legacy of the 1970s and trying to live up to that. And he always holds them in a pedestal, even above this team. And the documentary about that 70s team, Dublin, the Rare Old Towns, from a few years ago, that Colm Meaney narrated, Tony Hanahoe talks in that. At one stage, he said it was incredible to be part of a movement like that. And it's very odd to use language like a movement to talk about a football team, that you're talking about something social and culture thing. And I think people like Philly, like, you know, he's been asked about politics now. They see that they have power because of their position. And they're using it in a very positive way. Like Conor O'Callaghan, people giving out about this nonsense RTE thing last night. Who cares about that shortlist? It's like a public vote. Anybody can win as X Factor. But he was out in the sleep out for homeless people last night. Like, that matters. This other kind of stuff doesn't.
No, I tend to agree with you. And so ultimately, Niall, to finish up on it, like, John is a victim of his circumstances more than anything. Is that the core point that Philly's trying to make, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, that is the core of it, and I suppose without giving away the whole narrative and the whole arc of Philly's story, like, John found himself growing up in Ballymun at a time when heroin was so prevalent, and ended up taking his first hit of heroin when he was just 14 years old. Like, it's... Wow. Like, and I remember there were a few... I obviously went in knowing a bit of Philly's story from the interviews he's given over the past few years. He's obviously been quite open about John's relationship. And I remember the first time he told me that. And, like, it was genuinely, without exaggeration, a moment that would absolutely hit you and stop you in your tracks and think, how is that even,
yeah,
like thinking of what I was doing at 14 or like young cousins I have of around that age, you know, second year in secondary school or whatever it is. And it does just hit you in your tracks. And I think what John summed it up nicely, what Philly said the other day about it being the right thing to do, the one word, like, people have very generously used words like bravery and honesty and in their critique of the book. The one word that I would use to describe Philly is his generosity, and the generosity of him and his family to revisit all of this and go to a place that's still, in a lot of respects, like John only passed away in 2012, a lot of respects, some very raw emotion for Philly himself, a lot of emotions that he never really processed until he sat down to do this book, and do all of that in the hope of sharing their story so that somebody else might not have to go through what they went through, or that somebody else might have a better understanding of how to deal with that. And for me, that was like, that was the real privilege of being able to work with him on it.
Okay.
Can I add to,
yeah,
just add to that?
Final word on this, yeah.
Any person who has been in any way touched by addiction will be really, really blown away by this book. And they will... Philly clearly knew when he was starting out that he was going to write something that was going to have an impact on people. And he was very deliberate, clearly, in doing that. And if you have, if anyone has been touched in any way by addiction in a family or friend circle, this book will answer questions for them that they may have been carrying around for, you know, for a long time. I really believe that.
Yeah, I think that's the core of it, John. I think it's not just one of the sports books of the year, it's one of the books of the year.
Yeah.
Like, it shouldn't be getaways and people thinking, no, I'm no interest in sports books.
Yeah, it's an awful label to put on books anyway.
Yeah. We talked about The Choice. One book you all had in our Venn diagram here in the middle of the table is The Ascent, Barry Ryan, about the 1980s, a golden age for Irish cycling and a complicated age for Irish cycling. We're 30 years on from 87.
Hmm.
So yeah, it's been a strange way we've all dealt with the anniversary, largely ignoring it.
We were talking about it outside. It opens with an absolutely brilliant story. I don't know if I want to even give it away, but it's about what happened with the Irish cycling team in the 1972 Olympics. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about it. I'd vaguely heard and forgotten about it, but it's something, as Kieran, as you said outside, that why every time the Olympics come around, there isn't a package on what happened. It's so bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is the starting point for the book. And then, you know, 10 years later, you know, we're on the top of the world.
Yeah, I don't think it's giving it away, but like, basically, yeah, there was a rogue team that kind of gate crashed.
What do you mean, a rogue team?
There was an official team and then the gate crashing team. And I think one of them briefly led the race, because there was this dispute between different governing bodies.
Oh, here, I have heard this. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think there was an IRA connection from what I remember as well. It's an off the wall story.
Mm.
But like, to go from there in 72 to 10 years later, and you've Kelly and Roach starting to burn it up in the Tour de France.
Mm.
Then Roach eventually. Well, it's amazing. And one of the things I like about it is I love books when there's depth in it, in the sense of you read that and you know he's interviewed 40, 50 people easily. You know the depth of research. Also, I like his background. Barry writes for Cycling News, but he's a PhD in Italian. And I like people who come from a bit left of field, that, you know, of life experience just outside of journalism or outside the sport. Mm-hmm. Like Eamon Carr, I mentioned Eamon Carr in before. Like, Eamon was drummer for Horselips and then ran record companies, and then now he's, you know, we go in and write about the Dubs or write about boxing and stuff. He's a PhD in history of art. So this is, yeah. So like, I like people to come from somewhere different, like Barry is, and he doesn't duck the hard questions, because I remember I tweeted a picture of this book months before it came out, and I got some messages back. Oh, it'll be the typical, you know, it'll brush over Stephen Roach and Kelly and the questions over them, but he doesn't.
Mm.
You know, doesn't confront the things. And
does that theme run right the way through, or does he leave it for a certain chapter, or how's that done?
It simmers beneath the surface of the book.
Yeah.
He does deal with it specifically later on,
right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it does, because, you know, he's talked to, you know, David Walsh and Paul Kimmage, so their voices are through the book as well. It's not, he doesn't ignore the issue, but he tells the story kind of in a chronological way, starting with the 72 Olympics and working his way right through to the early 90s, is it?
Mm.
So obviously it does come up now and again, but he does deal with them in more specific terms.
Mm.
Yeah, and like John would remember as well, like you two guys would be too young to remember, but like, you wouldn't believe how big cycling was at that time. Like in terms of media coverage, and even like when the races came here, the crowds, like Pat McQuaid is quoted, I think, is one criterion, and there was 85,000 lining the roads going into Limerick. Limerick with this population of 60,000. Mm. So like it was, and you know, every paper used to send to the Tour de France, like, you know, like no Irish paper sends now, yeah. Do they? I don't think they're not many. Like it's just, it's amazing different. Like you see, it wasn't just about Kelly and Roach. Like Martin Early was there, Paul Kimmage was there. What's McCormick's name?
Alan McCormick.
Completely
figure.
Forgotten about Alan McCormick.
Mm. No, I've seen the snapper, and they get the bike and the costume. It was, you know, it was the Manchester United jersey of its day.
It's on tonight. You can watch it again.
Is it on tonight? Yes. Right, okay. So you said, Niall, maybe the outstanding Irish sports book, or certainly your pick of the Irish sports book.
Certainly my favourite show. I mean, and everything that John and Kieran have just said applies again. I think I am interested in cycling, but I am no way a cycling diehard. So I think, and it might be a partial admission of ignorance on my part, but a lot of the stories within the book I was coming to for the first time. Like I've obviously watched Roach and Delgado, and I'm familiar with, you know, the stories behind Irish cycling, but for me it brought me a number of moments and stories and incidents that I was never aware of before, and I was just so struck by the depth of research that Barry has done, and then how he managed to convey that in such a beautifully written style that at no point does it feel like you're reading a book that's weighed down by research, but it's so beautifully informed at every turn that, you know, you can't help but find an interesting nugget on every single page of it. And it really is, like, it's a brilliant book for anybody interested in Irish sport, anybody interested in Irish cycling. Like, it's an absolute winner.
Any nuggets that anyone wants to throw out or they were struck by?
The Munich one certainly was. It's such a absolute grabbing, like, for this to be happening the day after, I think the road race was scheduled for the day after the Munich atrocity, and in this mass confusion that was reigning for these two Irish teams, the real team and the team that was infiltrating, to come to that. And
Alan McCormick's journey to get to the World Championships in Austria, was it, Kieran? He travelled from travelled from the United States to Austria to make up, to be the fifth member of the cycling team at the World Championships.
Yeah.
And let's just say he didn't travel first class.
Right. So this is far from Roach and Kelly.
Yeah, it's no.
This is the full nuanced picture, complicated, different
Martin
characters.
Martin Early, the McQuaids, Paul's father Christy makes an appearance in it.
Kind of starts with Shea Elliott, just as to kind of to set the tone, and how Irish cycling moved in such a short space of time from this one lone ranger to having this squad of, or this array of, incredibly impressive talents.
And does a really good job of explaining how Kelly was just a freak, how he just came out of nowhere, and it just, like, was following an older brother, I think. Just going for a cycle for something to do.
Right. Incredible stories of, like, his lodgings in France and him arriving on a doorstep one night and essentially just sleeping on the doorstep because he didn't know where he was staying, and then getting up and going off out to ride a race the next day. Like,
it was some tough going.
Some fascinating.
It was hardship.
Right, okay. So everybody's recommended that, because Nathan here interviewed Barry Ryan a couple of weeks ago and he said it was absolutely outstanding as well. So everyone's given the ascent thumbs up.
This predated the Italian 90 and Euro 88 stuff as well. Like, it was, you know, this was the big sporting phenomenon of the 80s before. Yeah.
These two guys were world superstars.
Yeah.
Mm. So, one to touch on, I haven't read this. I heard Jonathan Ige interviewed on, it was on NPR or some podcast, and it sounded really interesting. So, Ali Alife. Like, you do think to yourself, you're a brave man to take on Ali, given the quality of rider who's covered Ali. It's almost like a poison chalice. There's almost an arrogance. What do you think you're doing in following in the steps of so many's from, like, Remnick's is unbelievably good. Yeah. Hauser's written about him. And there's just countless pieces about him. This is the first big Ali piece since his death.
Yeah, and it's the first, I guess, it builds itself as the first totally comprehensive biography of Ali. Like, when you look at Remnick, when you look at Hauser, when you look at Mailer, they all look at snapshots or fragments of Ali's life, and some of them do it in unbelievable detail. But this is the first one that kind of tries to go from day one to day dot, and it's, you were saying there, how do you even attempt to do this? And I think the only way you can attempt to do this is by doing what Jonathan Ige did, which was 5 years of research. I think it's 600 interviews with over 200 different people.
Wow.
And just incredible depth. I mean, if anybody wants to get a flavor, and maybe this is me exposing myself as the nerd that I am, but, like, if you want to get a flavor for this, go to the reference section at the back and look how detailed just the references are. Like every single word is nearly referenced. Every single word of Jonathan Ive's writing is nearly referenced and linked back to two or three different contemporary newspaper articles, all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And the reference section itself is could nearly have been a book. And that's how rooted in research this is, and brings some really fascinating new insights as well. He worked with CompuBox, I think it is, to try and calculate the total amount of punches that Ali would have taken over the course of his lifetime. He worked with
200,000,
yeah, which is incredible, really. Like, worked with a linguistics expert, and they were able to chart the decline in Ali's linguistic skills to a much earlier point in his life by analysing interview tapes and the audio of interviews to a much earlier point than anybody had truly realised.
How early?
Like early 30s, yeah. I think they're able to kind of begin to pinpoint it, and, you know, able to kind of put nearly a number on it. And I think just when you attempt something like this, and I think there's actually a 12-part podcast series with Jonathan Ive on the entire process of putting this together, which is fascinating for anybody. I haven't listened to it yet, but should be fascinating for anybody interested in putting sports books together and researching sports books. But you can only go 100% if you're going to attempt Ali, and I don't think anybody could certainly fault Jonathan Ive's endeavour in this.
I had just heard very good things about it. I was kind of against it when I first heard it was coming out. You know, how dare you do this? I was like, but The Economist, for instance, makes it sound bloody interesting. They say in their review, Mr. Ive's portrait is of a man who professed to do everything on instinct inside the ring and out. His impulses grappled with each other throughout his life. Ali was ravenous for fame, but he didn't have to be liked. He whipped white Americans into a fury, called his black opponents Uncle Toms. He lusted after money too, loved to run his hands through piles of his cash. He also became a sex addict. Ali was married 4 times and liked to play his wives off against each other, asking them to book hotel rooms for his romps. He was often caught with prostitutes on the day of a fight, yet he had his mother's generosity, turning up at hospitals and schools and dispensing charity to whoever asked for it. Sold.
Yeah. No, I haven't read it now, I have to be honest. And part of the reason is I knew this book would come up today, so I was out of curiosity, but just a little office at home, and I have 27 Ali books. And last year alone, I read 4 of them after he died. There's a couple I hadn't read. And then,
what's your favourite of the
David Remnick's King of the World, by a mile, is the best sports book I ever read. Because it's not, as the best sports books aren't, it's not just about sport. Like, it's a social history of America in the 60s, particularly the black experience. And also, I like Ghosts of Manila a lot, the Mark Cram one, which is another book that shows the ugly side of Ali, like particularly the race baiting. It goes into the womanizing to an extent as well. Like, it's funny, like a year ago, I think Dave Hannigan's Drama in the Bahamas, I thought that was the best Irish sports book last year, but it wasn't on the long list for the Air Award because I think the publisher hadn't entered it. So, you know, that's a flaw with the Michael Walker one this year. I don't think they'd entered it either. But like, the more I've heard about this Jonathan Ive one now, I think I will read it, because I was thinking, is there anything more? You know, how many books can I read about Ali? Is there anything more to learn? Because one of the very good things about Dave Hannigan's book last year, he did an index at the back of all the books he'd read, or, you know, and one of them, there was a few there and I hadn't, and like, there's one about his relationship with Howard Cosell, which is a really interesting book if you're interested in media in particular. But I thought after that, you know, I'll just give it a rest. And then I saw the reviews of this and I thought, you know, can there be anything new? But from what I've seen or heard about since, I'll definitely give it a go.
If you've read 27, what's 28 after all?
There are 600 pages in this, you need to be ready for it.
600? Okay, yeah. Right. So, The Warriors Code, Jackie Tyrrell. John, this is absolutely one as well I will read on Christmas Day. I was saying during the ad break I might leave the choice until after Christmas Day. But I know a few of the lads have read this in the office, and there's a lot of laughs in this, many of them involving Tommy Welch. And what we keep hearing about Jackie Tyrrell and Christy O'Connor's effort here is it's the definitive Kilkenny Cody era book. Nobody needs to write another one after this. He's nailed it. He's covered it. It's... the truth, or as close to the truth as we're
I wouldn't like to be, if you're on that part of that Kilkenny panel, I wouldn't, and had been thinking about a book, I wouldn't like to be trying to follow this. We serialised it in the paper. I have really been turned off sports autobiographies from previous years, and that was the first one that came to us this year, and I was very, very nervous of it. And then I said I'd have a look, and had a look, and after a couple of pages I said I'm definitely going to be putting this in the paper. And it was, I just couldn't believe that. You should be able to believe it, but we've been diluted with what we've been getting that I just thought, fair play to you for doing this. You know, this can't have been easy.
What's the most contentious kind of things he's put in there that Cody wouldn't be happy with, or people in the dressing room won't be happy with?
I don't think he's put anything contentious in. I think he's just told the story. Everybody marvels at what was the secret of this great Kilkenny team, and it turns out there was no secret.
Yeah.
You know, it was a culture. It was a group of extraordinary players and an extraordinary manager who came together at around the same time and moulded themselves into this unit of absolute... They were a weapon of mass destruction. They just blitzed everything before them, and they had an absolute terror of losing. They couldn't live with the idea of losing, like any great team. And all he's done is tell what we suspected. We'd never been told before what was going on. There was no GPS units until late. There was no scientific approach. There was no great nutrition thing going on, certainly not in the early days. They were going out to various different hurling fields in Kilkenny and hurling and hurling and hurling and hurling hard and toughening themselves up. And it was a bit like the Coliseum, man down, next man in. You know, you just had to... If you got injured, and Terrell got a few bad injuries during his career, and the absolute obsessiveness with his recovery to try and be back as quickly as he could before somebody else nailed down his spot was just unbelievable. So all he's done, really, is tell us all this.
Okay, so that's the contentious thing, as opposed to anything contentious.
I don't know what Brian Cody would have thought of it, but it is what it is.
Do you come out liking this Kilkenny team more?
I always liked them. I mean, I remember being at the... the 2008 final when they beat Waterford?
Yeah.
I remember I was sitting in the upper deck of the Cusa quite near the centre, and I was looking down in perfection, and I was just blown away. And, like, I mean, we all, as neutrals, went there hoping that this Waterford team, full of the characters that we'd really grown to like, would finally get their All-Ireland. But Kilkenny put in a performance that day that was just a performance for the ages.
Yeah.
So... there's a great line in the book, isn't there, where he says about the scoreline that day was we scored 3:30 that day, the same time the game started and the same time the game finished. It was just a brilliant line.
Yeah. What I find interesting is, like, I don't think it's particularly surprising at all what Jackie Turrell has said. As you say, John, I think people suspected this is the way Kilkenny were and the way Cody were, and that they're ruthless and driven and, you know, aggressive, and there's a kind of a macho edge, so they just want to drive other teams into the ground. But to put it out in the book, like, I read Cody's book, and you know, you know more about Cody. I think I knew less about him after reading it than I did before. I think he's very deliberate. That's not as disparaging the people who helped him with it. But it's interesting because, you know, Tommy Welch has been in here, worked for you guys during the summer, and he was brilliant. And, like, we're talking about sports books. I remember talking to Tommy. Tommy's obsessed with Christy Ring's, the biography of Christy Ring by Val Dorgan. And it's very interesting. There was a YouTube clip of one of the Kilkenny homecomings, and he's very funny. He puts on an act. Tommy is on a trailer in Thomastown or somewhere, and he's taken off of various people and taken off Brian Cody and impersonating various players, etc. And at one stage, he says, "We create a spirit that will never be broken," and it's a line of Ring's from that book. That's where he took it. And apparently, Cody said it to them from the start. He borrowed that ring for a line from Ring, "We'll create a spirit and never be broken." But the interesting thing about that clip went viral, and it disappeared of YouTube very quickly. I don't know how that happened.
There's a story in the book about another hurler with Kenny who sang something, did something similar, and
was
never seen again.
Yeah, sure, the scene just disappeared.
Do you know what? He'd be great to track down for an interview, actually. He would. Yeah, I remember that.
I'm just trying to remember his name.
I can't remember who he did. One of the Sundays during the summer, I think. Mm-hmm. It was good. It worked out in the radio.
But this this Kilkenny group, you've read this as well?
Yeah.
This Kilkenny group are a fun-loving group.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but, like, there was one story towards the end of it that really struck me, and they were away on a stag, and it was in the after the end of the 2013 season where Clare had won the All-Ireland, and Tommy Walsh is obsessed with Tony Kelly. Absolutely obsessed. Who do you want next year? I want Tony Kelly. Who do you want next year? I want Tony Kelly. And the lads are winding them up, and they're saying, Jackie's saying, "No, I'll take Tony Kelly. You take someone else." Saying, "No, I want Tony Kelly." That's how unbelievably driven it was that in November, I think it was, on a stag, a million miles away from the 2014 championship, that Tommy Walsh had in his head, he was like, Tony Kelly. Tony Kelly is my man for next year. I'm not going to let Tony Kelly get the better of me. Just to roll back onto the Cody stuff, I think as interesting as the insight we get into Cody is...
I'll let you make that point.
Yeah.
So what insight do you get to Cody?
The insight, I guess it was how he kept the players on edge, his relationship with them, and how he never let them get settled as a man manager was the thing that stood out the most for me. And the point that I was going to make is then the impact, like Jackie is uniquely positioned to give you an insight into how unnerving that can be as an elite athlete and the doubt that can be allowed to fester in your mind. Like, we look at Jackie Tyrrell now as a man with 9 All-Irelands and however many All-Stars he has and an absolute superstar of the modern game.
Mm.
And how he could be so crippled with doubt about himself and his capabilities and whether he belonged at this level, whether he belonged in this team, whether he was going to get that jersey the next day out. Because of this distance that Cody managed to keep between them, where nobody was as big as the team and nobody was guaranteed their place, and you know, just that uneasiness. And I'm not sure if that's genius man management or if it's terrible man management, but
seems to be fairly common. The more I read about this stuff, the more I'm starting to think that just racking your players with doubts and insecurities and worry is the secret to good management.
Kevin Heffernan line, the best way to manage a group of players is through fear and respect.
Yeah, it's funny, this will come up with the Bob Paisley thing whenever we come to that book as well.
Well, let's jump into it now. So everyone's given Jackie Tyrrell's big thumbs up. Christy O'Connor's done a really good job.
Absolutely.
Okay, 100%. So yeah, Bob Paisley, I hadn't heard much about this. Quiet genius, Ian Herbert.
Well, I was very curious about it because for such an incredibly significant figure in the history of English football, there were very little books about him at all. I'm not sure if there was any book about him, but there was definitely no great book about him. Similarly with Bill Shankly, strangely enough. And so, you know, if you looked at Bob Paisley from the outside, he came across as this kind of cosy, kind of grandfatherly type figure with his cardigans and the slippers in the office. You know, maybe flat cap type North of England, but
yeah, some spilt runny egg on his cardigan. But distinctly unfascinating.
No, but
I would say.
Yeah, but then if you look at it, you know, read about his career. You know, it goes into his background, and you know, he drove a tank during the war. You know, he was player at Liverpool, went into coaching, but he was a number two. He didn't want the job. Yeah. Like Bill Shankly shocked them all when he took it. He didn't want. He begged Shankly not to go, and he begged the board not to give it to him. But then very quickly, this incredibly ruthless streak came out that a couple of months afterwards, or straight afterwards, Shankly knew he'd made a mistake and he started to turn up at training and the players called him boss, and he had Shankly banned from training. You know, the most iconic figure in the history of the club. A year later, his first year in charge was poor. They won nothing. And Shankly had made it clear to the board he wanted to come back. And Paisley, even though he'd won nothing, he didn't want the job. He said, no, I'm going to do it. And like his strength was, like, it was very interesting, the interviews with players in it. Most of them didn't like him. Like he was, you couldn't say what we would think of good man management. He didn't have those skills. There was no communication. You know, usually if a player was dropped, they found out by reading the Liverpool Echo. Like, he wouldn't tell them. If the player went to challenge Paisley, he would just, he would waffle and, you know, he would try and just change the subject or walk out of the room. He wouldn't be able to explain the reasons or stand up behind it. And he wasn't a brilliant tactician, but his strength was he had incredible eye for players. So, because if you look at where they came, the Liverpool teams had won European Cups. Alan Hansen came from Partick Thistle, Emlyn Hughes from Blackpool, Ian Rush from Chester City, Graeme Souness from Middlesbrough, Ronnie Whelan from Home Farm, Steve Highway was bought a bit earlier, but he was from non-league and Skelmersdale United. Like, they all came from lower league teams. Like, he had this eye for talent. He would pick the best players and keep them motivated. That was his strength. But like, it's a sad story as well, because he ended up with Alzheimer's, and he couldn't remember managing Liverpool, which is very sad given what he'd done for the club. And the early signs of that were starting to come into play when he was interviewed for the Ireland job. You know, and I don't know if you know that story, but, you know, there's an incredible story about that. Do you know that story?
Yeah,
but
I've heard it before, yeah.
Yeah, but, like, he won the vote. Like, there was a vote. It was between him, I think it was him, John Giles, Billy McNeil, and Jack Charlton were the last four or something. But by far, Charlton won the first ballot comfortably. And then the second, it went down the last ballot, was between him and Charlton, but somebody changed the vote. Like, it looked like Paisley was going to walk it, but But like it was a like it would have been very bad for him and for Ireland because of his mental health at the time. He wasn't ready for. But it's really interesting because just a huge figure in the game that's been you know, nobody has written about properly for some reason.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. That's by Ian Herbert, quiet genius Bob Paisley. Because I do remember, I think there was a charity game for him when he was quite. The disease had progressed. I remember seeing the footage, and he really degenerated. Terribly, it was very, very sad.
Yeah.
But, so that is worth the read for Liverpool
definitely
fans.
Worth the read,
okay,
yeah.
We're here with Niall Kelly, who has written The Choice this year with Philly McMahon and works, of course, at The 42. John Green, sports editor at The Sunday Independent, and Kieran Cunningham from The Irish Daily Star. So we have touched in a bit of depth on The Choice, on The Ascent by Barry Ryan, on Jackie Tyrrell's book, and on Quiet Genius by Ian Herbert about Bob Paisley. We're going to rip through some others, and the Ali book, actually, which I think plenty of people will check out all 600 pages of it. We're going to run through some others with a bit more speed so we can all just jump in and talk over each other a bit more. So other ones mentioned have been Green Shoots, Boy Wonder, there's Jason Sherlock's book, there's Own Hand, there's Kieran Fallon, there's Frank Bruno, Colm Cooper, Shea Given, to name but a few. Centaur, Declan Murphy with Amy Rowe.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get going.
I want to mention the Cormac McAnallan book simply because I have it right up there. It's an unusual book. It's written by his brother Donal. It's another, you know, it's 14 years, is it 13 years since Cormac died. I really didn't know what to expect when I started this book. It's quite a big book, and you're just wondering, you know,
what's in it?
What's in it?
Yeah.
So what's in it is just an extraordinary record of an ordinary guy who was extraordinary, but the level of detail that Donald, who was a few years older than Cormac, has about him, it's just it blew my mind. I mean, two of them were obsessed with quizzes. Every quiz that they had as kids, he's kept the score and he still has them. If they played one-on-one football at the back, he had the scores of that. He knew everything about him, even when he was living in college in Belfast. He had his diaries. He knew all the things that he was doing. So there's 300 odd pages in the book, and the first 200 of them are about Cormac's life growing up as a boy, a teenager, and into young adulthood, and about how his football career fitted into his life. But he was also an extremely intelligent guy growing up.
Okay, I'll jump in with the kind of crueler thought that might pop into a head. Well, I would presume Cormac and the McAnallans lived a fairly ordinary life growing up, and so those 200 pages, what would they have that would really jump out and grab me? Is it not just similar to every childhood?
It is, but right. I mean, I don't know about
that's
you, but
you
ask me about my childhood and I'd be able to tell you very little about it. I couldn't remember. But he was also in Blackpool. He won a bus for his local school on Blackpool Jungle on the quiz programme, wearing his Tyrone jersey. He just was a very unusual guy. And the other thing about it is the picture that we get of growing up in Northern Ireland in the 90s in a small nationalist community. Really interesting picture of the life that they lived. And then you come to the part where, you know, where Cormac dies tragically at home. And it's some of the best writing that you're going to read this year. Is just like Donald was in the house at the time and just presenting. He presents it's almost like a news report at times in the factual account of what happens and then the emotion in between it. And I wrote last week that he clearly had agonised over every word, and he sent me a message during the week saying, "You were right. I agonised over every single word, and it must have been a very painful journey for him." Because,
and that's what struck me, John, is I would say he spent. I don't know how. I would say he spent a long number of years.
Say he is years, and I mean to have to go through and read all his diaries, and obviously the family helped. It's an ordinary story about an ordinary person, you know, who dies tragically, and it is like every other childhood, but it's the recall of that childhood and the simple things and the simple pleasures that they got, and describing league matches, under 12 matches, under 14 matches, and telling you what happened in them. I just thought it was an extraordinary piece of work, and it's one of those books that will stand the test of time, because of the social history element that's involved in it as well.
Yeah. Okay. Leicester scored an early try against Munster, so after 15 minutes they lead by 10 points to 3. Matt Tate with the early try for Leicester at Welford Road after 15 minutes. It looks cold there as well. Okay, so that gets more than an honourable mention, The Pursuit of Perfection, The Life, Death and Legacy of Cormac McAnallan. Where else do we want to go on this?
I'd like to go into the just quickly the Michael Walker, The Green Shoots book.
Yeah.
Because there's been a huge amount of GA books over the last few years, and a lot of them have been outstanding. Rugby is well served with books. Like, I think the last I checked of the Grand Slam team from 2009, 8 of them have published autobiographies, which is incredible.
Nothing actually this year. There's no rugby this year.
No, Gatlin's Diary. No, they're
just
all Lions.
The Lions, 1970. Yeah.
Is that good?
Yeah, that is good.
All Lions, really. But soccer is badly served. But what I found with Irish soccer is the few books that have been there, a lot of them are really good, like Paul McGrath's autobiography, Tony Cascarino's, Dave Hannigan's The Garrison Game, and now Michael Walker's Green Shoots. Because I like one of the things I like, it's a 32 county account of the growth of the game here. So there's a lot of stories people here might know, and they wouldn't know a story, but there's like the chapter on Liam Brady in Italy is really interesting, particularly younger people who wouldn't remember that time. Like what he did there is, it's incredible. Like that somebody from the English league going over there, but from an Irish player, to become the main man at Juventus, and you know, score the penalty that wins them the league, and play outstanding football. Like, there's clips of YouTube of him playing there, and they blow you away. Like it's Messi-esque, some of the stuff. But there's loads of little nuggets which I like about it. There's a lot of detail in this. Like William McCrum from Milford and Armagh invented the penalty kick. A guy, Bill McCracken from Belfast, he came up with his defensive traps on Newcastle United were so clever, they had to change the offside rule. And do you remember the penalty Thierry Henry and Robert Pires that went wrong when he played the ball short? And people said it was a Johan Cruyff penalty that he was copying. But apparently it was Peter Doherty, who was another Northern player that came up with it originally.
Right.
And there's also little, like Jimmy Quinn scored the goal against Northern Ireland in the 93 World Cup, the final game. I didn't realise, he's from Rathcoole, a Catholic, and three of his brothers joined the British Army. Like there's a lot of detailed stories about the individuals involved in the sport, that like Frankie Kerr, Brian's father, who was a boxer in Belfast, like his background in the game, etc. It's one well worth seeking out, because I think it might slip under the radar a bit because it wasn't on the air list. It wasn't on the air list because I think the publishers didn't enter it, but because of that, there hasn't been as much focus on it.
Okay, that sounds good. Green Shoots, Michael Walker. Centaur is worth mentioning for sure. Declan Murphy with Amy Rowe. So Declan Murphy, 1994, he has a fall. There's an obituary written in the Racing Post that evening because the fall is so bad and the horse is trod on his head. It's fractured in 12 places, and it's about his recovery. It's about him ultimately not remembering any of his career as a jockey. And I know he was in, and the interview got a great reaction during the summer. This has been very highly regarded and well reviewed as well. Has anyone read this?
That's the one I'd like to read. You've read it?
The one thing that I think has pretty much unanimously been said about this so far this year is it's probably the most beautifully written of the sports books. Like Amy Rowe has done a magnificent job. It's just very poetic in places, and it does a really, really great job. Like there's a serious, this goes without saying, but there's an incredible challenge in trying to write a memoir or an autobiography when somebody can't remember four of the most important years of their life.
Yeah.
And Amy Rowe and Declan Murphy are very upfront about how they address this. The comparison has been made a few times with Vincent Hogan and Paul McGrath on Back from the Brink, where they went and exploited absolutely every resource that was available to them, spoke to everybody who might have known or worked with Paul. And Amy Rowe and Declan Murphy have done the same thing here. They've gone and they've sought out the people that were in the weigh room the day of his accident. They've gone and sought out family and friends.
And pieced it together
in the most beautiful way. And it's an incredible story that this man was sitting in his bed reading the obituary that had been prepared for him by the Racing Post. And yet, down the line then, ends up getting back on a horse, riding a horse and winning on a horse.
Yeah.
Like, it's a fascinating story. So many layers, for personal and professional.
Well, I saw Paul Kimmage in a piece a couple of weeks ago musing on whether or not to buy Gucci's autobiography, mentioned the opening to books and how important they were. Mm. And he says at one point, consider how Amy Rowe, a writer you've never heard of, compels you to buy a book you don't want to read about a jockey you had forgotten about. And he has the following, I presume this is close to the opening of the book. There is a symphony in the movement of a horse. The gallop, for example, is a four-beat rhythm. Hind leg, foreleg, foreleg. You just have to listen for it to hear it as I hear it, and you'll realise how musical it is, how beautifully poetic. There, this is the gait of the racehorse. It strikes off with its non-leading hind leg, then the inside hind foot hits the ground before the outside four, but just by a split second, the movement concludes with the striking off of the leading leg, followed by a moment of suspension, when, in glorious majesty, all four hooves are off the ground. Even at 35 or 40 miles per hour, when the animal appears to be flying, it follows this classic controlled cadence. In truth, it is not flying at all, it is dancing. And he goes on to talk about how in this way we've understood each other, my horse and I, our bodies in perfect sync, the energy between us reverberating like the silent echoes of an unspoken voice. This is how I've always ridden, by an instinct deep and wonderful. And there's further quotes there. That gives people a sense. This,
if you ever wanted an understanding of how horsemanship works, I mean, that opening page does it all.
Okay, yeah, I'd heard good things about it. Speaking of horsemanship, Kieran Fallon's book, I've read this, you read this?
Yeah, I read it.
What did you think?
I understand that the book was turned around in something like 10 weeks.
Ollie Holt.
Yeah. To do that and to produce the book that he's produced is some achievement. There's gaps in the book, I think. You know, I think that's, you know, there's a little bit of selective memory involved in it. Yeah. I was really, I don't know about you, but I would have really liked to have found out more about his dad. He's a very, very interesting figure.
Why was the time frame over. So tight? I can't see why there would have been time pressure.
I don't
like,
know. I don't know. I just had heard that.
Right.
And
that explains a lot, actually.
Yeah.
The
stuff around the trial is really, really interesting. Yeah, it explains it really well. But his dad is a really curious figure, certainly in the early stages in the book as well. And clearly is a lot of the reason behind Fallon is the way he is. Mm. That kind of hard, uncompromising nature that he has.
And vulnerable broken in many
then,
ways.
Well, yeah. You know, the family, a sister died while they were young, and that clearly damaged all of the family. And they never seemed to recover from it. They didn't grieve, you know, in any apparent way. And Fallon just drifted into, seemed to discover, he clearly had no way with people. That comes across in the book. And very soon he discovered that he had a gift with horses.
Yeah.
He tended to befriend some very strange people along the way. And it kind of was a case of, you know, how unlucky can you be to keep meeting with somebody who's going to get you in trouble. But for all of the flaws in it, it's a very good book. It's a very interesting insight into him. I think he's a fascinating person.
In some ways I came away more fascinated with more questions.
That's the problem. Kind of okay. There are questions.
Might be a follow-up type piece at some stage. We've run out of time, as I always suspected we would. We've about 30 seconds. You wanted to make a point about sports fiction, you
said
to me?
It's just that you know, when we talk about sports books, we never talk about sports fiction. And it was somebody said it to me during the week, and then Ian O'Riordan from the Irish Times has been doing a thing on Twitter all week where he's been doing his top 10 running books, and number 7 was Once a Runner, which is a book I've never read.
Yeah.
And it reminded me that I hadn't read it and that I need to track it down. It's a novel about a runner. And, you know, outside of, you know, the Myron Bolitar, Harlan Coben detective series, we don't tend to get introduced a lot to sports fiction. And somebody just reminded me that there's a couple of guys writing in Ireland at the moment. Ger Siggins is one and John O'Brien is the other, and they're doing sports fiction for kids.
Okay.
I haven't read any of their books, but I've seen them, and it just struck me on the foot of that conversation, it might be an interesting way to introduce our most literate 10-year-olds to sport reading about sport in a different way.
Yeah,
that was it's just something we don't think of.
That's how I got into it, reading fictional books about football teams. Can't remember the authors.
Riverside Rovers.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah, I
never read any of that.
Yeah, I was big into that as a kid, yeah. Are we done, Richie? Are we wrapping up? Okay, we're done. Sorry, we're out of time. I knew we were never going to touch anything. If there's anything else, please tweet and recommend. But thanks to Niall Kelly, and well done again. Kieran Cunningham, as ever. And John Green, thanks.
Off the Ball on Newstalk. In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.